Well, brethren, let's turn to the Song of Solomon, chapter 1. And does everyone have a handout from last week? We'll be at the back page on the bottom. One for Renee, too. This one's called The Ultimate Song at the top. We're at the back, right down there. Anyone else? You guess? Well, I have to be extra kind to you tonight, don't I? All right, brethren, let's have a prayer. Oh, great God in heaven, how wonderful is your word. It is so beautiful. Thank you for giving it to us, and thank you for loving us, being so kind toward us. You revealed so much in the Bible, and yet the Bible is brief in comparison to what you do know. And we know that you could just overwhelm us just by simply doubling the size of the Bible. So while the Bible seems big to us, we know that it is very small to you, but it is enough. And it is adequate to help us do whatever needs to be done. In the name of Jesus we pray, amen. Twice today, and it's kind of what prompted my prayer, I had discussions with people about the Bible, and I was kind of disappointed in the things that some people were saying. The lady who cut my hair today, she was telling, you know, she knows I'm a preacher, and she was telling me about this book that she's reading called The Isaiah Effect. Have you heard that? Anyone else? Can you tell me about it, Dorothy? You've just heard of it. Okay. Well, I think, I don't know if she's representing it properly or not, but she's basically coming across the idea with that the Dead Sea Scrolls have a whole lot of information that the Bible left out. And she mixed it up with a lot of other things, the Mayans and this and that and this and that and this and that. Kind of like things were intentionally left out of the Bible. And I said, well, or that what is written has been changed or rewritten. Now, if you remember, I had a class here on the canonicity of the Bible, and I asked, well, show me where the Bible has been changed, because people say that all the time. They say it's been rewritten, or its doctrines have been changed. Well, okay, show me what the original was. Well, what is interesting, though, is she just talked the whole time about this. Every once in a while, I would try and start to say something, and she'd keep on coming along with more stuff. And the other lady that she works with, who's her co-owner, they're arguing back and forth about this. And I could tell they've argued a lot about it. So I'm kind of like, okay, I'm caught in the middle here, because this other lady believes the Bible pretty strong and says, ooh, he's on my side. She can kind of, so I'm like, I don't want to get caught on either side here. I just, you know. Anyways, I've tried to get her to subscribe to my email devotionals before. I tried to get her to come worship here and so forth and so on. Well, she just hasn't done that. But she'll pick up a book that tells her that this isn't all that there is to it and there's more. And she's really a nice lady. Maybe she'll have to change her heart someday. And then, a couple days ago, I guess it was last week, do you all know where Planned Parenthood is here in town? It's on Washington Street there. Well, there was a man out front, you know, protesting that and telling people what abortion is, all that kind of stuff. So as I walked by, I told him I appreciated that. And, he's taking a bold stand. And I said, you can come worship with us anytime. I said, we're right down here on Savage Street. You know, just keep going all the way down to Washington, turn left on Savage, you know, through the 7th Street, here you are. Well, he called Monday or Sunday here, actually, and then I wrote down his number and thought I had lost it, and I found it again, so I called him today and we had a talk. And the reason he had called is because he wanted to talk about the fourth commandment. Does anyone know what the fourth commandment is in the Ten Commandments? The Sabbath. I thought, oh. There's a guy who called from Motel 6 a couple weeks ago, and man, he just blasted me, and of course I probably blasted him right back. So, Chris is this guy's name, and we talked, and I kept challenging him, saying, show me in the New Testament, especially in the epistles, where any of the apostles taught the church to keep the Sabbath and the penalty for not keeping it. And he wouldn't give me a passage. And somehow, in our discussion, I brought up Colossians 2:14 and following, which says the law of Moses was nailed to the cross. Therefore, at about 16 or 17, Paul says, don't let anyone judge you in regard to a Sabbath. So I said, Chris, you can't judge me on this matter. Well, he couldn't even find the verse in his Bible. He says, just go ahead and read it to me. I said, no, I'd really like you to read along with me. So finally, eventually he found it. And I talked to a pastor the other day, and he brought up the same passage. Okay, well, there must be a reason why. I mean, and he just was furious at me and says, that's it, bye. Boom, hung up on me. And I thought, well, if I'm misunderstanding the passage, he says he used it the same way you did. Okay, well, hey, maybe I'm wrong. I won't have any problem with that. I'll be willing to change. Tell me how I'm wrong, you know. Of course, he didn't do that. He just ended the conversation. So, I'm just, the reason I was praying that about the Bible is because twice today I was just kind of disappointed in people that show an interest in the Scriptures, but not in all the Scriptures or in what they actually say. And of course, you know, we need to make sure that we always have the right attitude towards Scripture. So now, having said that, let's look. Go ahead, Wita. No more dreams, right? Okay, all right. It must be. It just, he doesn't know what to do with that passage. Paul's argument is just so easy to follow. Yeah, you must be right. Okay, and this is on your handouts. It's on the back side, or I know I don't have them numbered, but and the very last part, the nature of love in the Song of Solomon. Some of these things we've already covered. But I just want to at least cover them again. Remember that in the Song of Solomon we have a love that is because of rather than in spite of. And the reason I emphasize that is because we're so used in the church to talking about what we might call agape love. You've probably heard that there's different Greek words for love in the New Testament. And agape love is a kind of love that can love your enemies. You don't love your enemy because they're so wonderful. You love them in spite of their unlovableness. So that's how we're used to thinking. But the Song of Solomon, the whole time, remember, as you're going through, you're going to be seeing, I love you because of all these good qualities. And that's okay. It's okay to love someone because of their good qualities. And in my mind, I think their love for one another is so strong that it appears as though they can't see any faults in the other. Now, is there anything wrong with that kind of love? We need more of that kind of love. You know, I love you so much because of the good things that are in you that I can't see your bad things. Okay, so secondly, what we have here is romantic love. Again, that's not something that we're used to talking about when we're in a Bible class and we're looking at Bible books. You know, we don't talk about romantic love. And the Bible doesn't talk a whole lot either. I understand that, but it does talk about it. And it is right here in the Song of Solomon. So it's okay to talk about that stuff. You know, it's not sinful, it's not evil, there's nothing bad about it. I think it's unfortunate that a lot of people think that it is evil, and it's not. Okay? Thirdly, it's ideal. There's no doubt about that. I mean, we're looking at an ideal situation. People who are looking at each other in an ideal way. And I don't know that that's necessarily bad. I think it's a good thing. something that we all need to learn to do. Number four, we're looking at love in marriage or what leads to it. Remember, it's the Song of Solomon is not necessarily following a chronological order. Okay, it's a series of love poems, and so you're going to have them jumping around at different spots. Okay, just as they talk about their relationship, like, you know, you and with your spouse, you may talk about your marriage now, but then, even though you've been married for a few decades, you may talk about the time before you were married, just reminiscing about something. Well, they do the same thing, okay? And number five, it's not the whole picture. I mean, this is not all there is to marital love, and we need to understand that. And I'm not trying to present to you that this is all that there is, but I'm saying that there is this. And this book is something wonderful that we need to read. And as you know, there are a lot of other things in the Scriptures that talk about either love or marriage. So now I have a handout for our next section here. Just one? Okay. Okay, now, the first major section of the Song of Solomon is chapter 1, verse 2, all the way through chapter 2, verse 7. Okay, verse 1 is just simply an introduction. The Song of Song, which is Solomon's. But now, we have this different section here. As I just said, chapter 1, verse 2 through chapter 2, verse 7. And so, I think what we need to see in this passage is, see love for what it is, and then speak it to one another. That's what they're doing in this passage. Okay, so first now, let's look at verses 2 through 6. And by the way, as you know, I use the New King James Version. So, some of the different translations are going to tell you at different points that it's someone else speaking than what maybe I will have. Okay? Do you see how, I'm sure yours has little subtitles, like the beginning of verse 2 says the Shulamite, or the Shulamith. And then, after the first line in verse 4, the daughters of Jerusalem. Then the Shulamite again, it kind of goes back and forth like that. Do you all see what I'm talking about? Do you see what I'm talking about, Elsie? How it identifies the speakers? In your text? Okay, alright. Maybe not every Bible has that. But first chapter, yeah. For example, like in verse 7, she's speaking to her beloved, who is Solomon. Then he speaks in verse 8. And I have little subheadings that tell me that. And the reason they figured that out is because of the Hebrew, and, you know, whether it's singular or plural, whether it's masculine or feminine or whatever. And then sometimes it's not always clear to the translators, and so it goes accordingly. Gene?
This is a New International, but it starts out with beloved and then goes to friends and then lover. That makes it sound like there's three individuals here.
Right. There's going to be the Shulamite, Solomon, and the daughters of Jerusalem. That's the way mine's divided up. And in verse 4, it can get a little confusing, but hopefully we'll be able to follow it along, okay? So verses 2 through 6. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is better than wine. Because of the fragrance of your good ointments, your name is ointment poured forth. Therefore the virgins love you. Draw me away. We will run after you. the king has brought me into his chambers. We will be glad and rejoice in you. We will remember your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you. I am dark, but lovely, O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. Do not look upon me because I am dark, because the sun has tanned me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me the keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard I have not kept. Okay, so let's go back to verse 2. She begins kind of speaking in the third person. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. As though she's speaking to a vast audience. That doesn't necessarily mean that he's not there. But she's just speaking into the air, so to speak, about what she wants from him. Why does she say, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth instead of just let him kiss me? Is it just part of the poetry? Just trying to be more picturesque? You know, I don't know. That's just the idea that I get from it. And then, why does she want him to kiss her? According to verse 2. Rick? Because your love is better than wine. How is love better than wine? Okay. So love lasts, can last forever. Wine does not. Is wine made accidentally?
Made to sell.
Pardon?
Made to sell, make money.
Okay. So in a picture like this, it's something that's made and it's made well. It takes skill to make it. But love takes greater skill. To create love takes a lot more skill than it does to make wine. So, in other words, it's more valuable. It's more to be cherished. It's more precious. In verse 3, what is going on there? All of a sudden she brings up the idea of ointments. Because of the fragrance of your good ointments, did he have a reputation for what he had made? Because of what? Because of the savor. S-A-V-O-R. Right, okay, because of the savor of your ointments. All right. So it sounds to me like he's got a reputation. I mean, he's a king. He can have things made and he can have the best made. So what did that do to his name? Wait, what was that, Dorothy? His name is known, and Gene makes it popular. And so his name is like the ointments that he's had made. Okay, Dorothy? Okay, yes. Yeah, I've had that experience, right. Yes.
So his fragrance must be very...
Okay, and so in the same way, his name went out in a good way. Therefore, she said what? No, right after that. Right after the ointments. Still, therefore the virgins love you. Okay? And I think, based upon what we'll see later in the song, is she's referring to all these other wives and concubines, which I think lends to the theory that I brought up to you, that they weren't necessarily loves. They weren't his love. They were married to him, but they're still virgins. Okay? But they still desired him. They desired to be married to the king. He provided them with every good thing. So he had a good name. He's a lover of God. God loved him. He had God's wisdom. He had wealth. Therefore, they loved him, so what does she want? Verse 3. What's the very first thing that is said in verse 3? Or verse 4, sorry. Verse 4. That lead me away, draw me away. Okay, so then the daughters of Jerusalem say, we will run after you. And then she states that the king has brought me into his chambers. This is the first time that she refers to him as the king, and she'll do so again later. And now the daughters come back again, we'll be glad and rejoice in you. And again, what do they say? That she has already said about love. That's right. Your love is, remember, your love more than wine. Again, it was a very beautiful and precious and wonderful thing. So, she then said, rightly do they love you. Now, in verses 5 and 6, she refers to herself. And something very, I think, very interesting is going on here. This is where all commentators, and I'm including myself in that, see her as not being of nobility. She does not come from nobility. She's not of royalty. She's come from a different place than nobility. Where has she been? She's been in the vineyards working. She's been where, Gene? In the sun. And what has it done to her? Yeah, it's darkened her, giving her a tan. Now, in this case, is she stating it? Is it a good thing or a bad thing in this passage? What was that? Yeah, it's not a good thing. Whereas today we would look at it as being a good thing. Well, we did for a while. Now everyone's scared to death of the sun, so we're starting to run to the other extreme now. But one of our preachers in the Brotherhood said this, and I think he was right. It is a trait of all cultures that beauty is the opposite of the norm. In other words, everyone that she was associated with in the past was out in the sun. They were darkened. They were laborers. And it showed up in their skin. But what about nobility? Where are they spending their time?
Inside.
Okay. That's right. So now she comes in among them and they see that she's different. You're not one of us. So she says, don't look at my outward appearance. The real person that I am is on the inside. So that's why she says in verse 5 at the very beginning, I am dark but lovely. She's not saying, you know, I'm just really a wonderful person. Yeah. I think she's trying to say, if you want to see my beauty, look at me on the inside. That's where the true person is. And we would agree to that, wouldn't we? Isn't that where true beauty is? Now, you're going to notice here, though, in this song, that outward beauty is never put down. In fact, it's enhanced. So that can be a good thing. But ultimately, we know that what's on the inside is where the true beauty is. So, why was she out in the vineyards? Okay, she's taking care of it, but it almost sounds like she kind of didn't belong there. Somebody forced her out there. Her brothers, that's right. Her brothers were angry. We don't know why. But they were angry at her. They must have been older, or maybe they were in charge of the vineyards or what, I don't know. But they made her go out there and work. So, she neglected something. What was it?
Her own vineyard.
Her own vineyard. Now, I don't know if she's talking about her own literal vineyard or herself. Because that's what she's been talking about. She's been talking about her outward appearance. So, I've not been able to take care of myself like all you ladies have been. here in Solomon's royal court. And that's because I've been forced out into the vineyard by my brothers. Okay, so now the next section is verses 7 through 11. Carl?
Does she reference her own vineyard later? Not in this verse, but later on?
I want to say yes. Do you have a passage?
I don't.
Okay, I think in chapter 8, I think she does again. But I don't remember exactly what the comparison is at that point. Okay, so 7 through 11. Tell me, O you whom I love, where you feed your flock, where you make it rest at noon. For why should I be as one who veils herself by the flocks of your companions? If you do not know, he's now speaking, O fairest among women, follow in the footsteps of the flock and feed your little goats beside the shepherd's tents. I have compared you, my love, to my filly among Pharaoh's chariots. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with chains of gold. We will make you ornaments of gold with studs of silver. All right, so now you see how in verse 7, she's not there with him. And she desires to be with him, so she wants to know where he is. And it's almost like he's playing a game. And how does he say you can find me? Yeah, I mean, why doesn't he just come out and say? Well, he's being playful the way I see it going on there. And then, what's the comparison that he makes in verse 9? What is she like to him? Or to one particular kind of horse? What was that, Rick? To a filly, where? What was that, Dorothy? Okay. So what's going on here? Listen to this commentator. In ancient Egypt, after the middle of the second millennium BC, mares were never used to draw chariots. Stallions, hitched in pairs, were the standard motive power of both war chariots and other royal vehicles. Yet the text here has the feminine singular mare. The preposition linked with chariots is better translated among rather than as a possessive. So, and I think the New King James has that. Yeah, I have compared you, my love, to my filly among Pharaoh's chariots. These factors suggest that the comparison here underscores the girl's attractiveness. A mare let loose among the royal stallions would create intense excitement. Okay, and then in verse 10, I think that kind of lends a little bit more to that. He's talking about her beauty in verse 10. Your cheeks are lovely with ornaments, your neck with chains of gold. And are not horses, or were not, maybe, and now as well, often decorated in just the very way he says in verse 10? And so now he sees her with whatever ornaments she's wearing or whatever it is that she has on in a comparable way. She gets his attention. Rick.
In the New King James Version, it says, oh, my love, to a company of horses and Pharaoh's chariots. That's it.
Okay. So it says what again?
Oh, my love, to a company of horses and Pharaoh's chariots.
It sounds incomplete to me. You're not reading the New King James. Okay.
It says, oh, I have compared thee, O my love, to a company of horses and Pharaoh's chariots.
Okay, yeah, okay, now I understand. Okay. And that's who you have also hope. Gene.
This one says, I liken you to a mare harnessed to one of the chariots of the Pharaoh.
Yeah. And I wondered if that was my first impression of it also. And just that he was just saying, you know, she's extremely valuable. I mean, Israel didn't supply this filly, but Egypt did because they were known for that. But as I read some more of the other commentators and so forth, they lended support to what I was showing here, that in time they didn't use fillies in among Pharaoh's chariots, but again, that she would get, a filly would get the attention of the stallions, and she was kind of the same way. She got people's attention. Right. Yeah, and see, in America, you know, our culture is not anymore built around a horse. It's built around the car. So when you have a culture that's built around the horse and what it can do, horses become exceedingly valuable and precious. So, you know, I don't know what women think of verse 9 or not, but I would encourage you to look at that, not with 21st century American eyes, but with, what, 10th or 11th century B.C. Israelite eyes, or Egyptian eyes. Dave?
Well, I was raised with horses and worked with them. And so I'm not speaking just from something I read. You never put stallions together unless you never put a stallion mixed with a mare. And if you wanted a gentle team that was not going to run off, you put mares together, work them together. And they were generally gentle, more docile, easier to take care of.
Uh-huh. Put stallions together, okay. And that's
what they were talking about here when the stallions were in war chariots.
Right.
You wouldn't want mares out there with a bunch of stallions and a bunch of war chariots.
You would want stallions then. Okay. So yeah, so that to me kind of lends more of an idea to the filly among the stallions and the attention. And she was that same way. It reminds me of Esther. You know, the book of Esther talked about Esther being the same way, how she got everyone's attention wherever she went. Yes?
As I get it, the beauty of the face, whatever it described, is the first attraction. It's an attraction to get the person to see, recognize. But she mentioned there, the second is the inner beauty. That gives them a chance to
right. That's right. Yeah, I mean, obviously, whenever you meet anyone, the first thing you notice is the outward, you know. But then, obviously, as you get to know a person, you get to know what they are on the inside. But in the case of a man and a woman, a husband and a wife, there's obviously going to be some kind of physical attraction. I mean, I would say in most cases, if not all cases, at least at first. And then they get to know one another, and they see that they're one and have a lot of things in similarity. Right. That's right. Okay, so now let's look at verses 12 through 14. While the king is at his table, my spikenard sends forth its fragrance. A bundle of myrrh is my beloved to me, that lies all night between my breasts. My beloved is to me a cluster of henna blooms in the vineyards of En-Gedi. He's at his table, and what happens? What happens in verse 12? Okay. Now, do you have perfume or spikenard, or what do you have in your text?
Perfume
worth its. Okay. And some of your translations will have spikenard that I have here, which was something that they got from India. So that right there made it exotic. And why are you going all the way to India to get it? Well, because there's something good about it. So it's good, it's exotic, it's expensive. Okay. And then he or she compares him to what in verse 13? To a bundle of myrrh. Like she has some kind of what I want to call a sachet or something like that. Am I using the right word? You know, that is hanging here, and so she can put the myrrh in there, whether it's solid or liquid or whatever, and it gives off its fragrance. And because it's in something like that, not just put on the skin like we might perfume, it's a constant aroma. And she says, he is like that to me. And that helps to give off more. So, is this a unpleasant or pleasant experience? And very, very pleasant. That's what she's saying. He's very pleasant to me. And my experience with him right now is very pleasant. And then she makes another comparison in verse 14. To what? And where? Okay, now, or I have henna blooms in, yeah, at En Gedi. Does anyone have in your Bibles where En Gedi was? Gene? No, on the west shore of the Dead Sea. This was just a special place. I looked up on the internet today just to look at pictures of, okay, this is where they say En Gedi was. I was going to say it's a warm place, but I guess all of Israel over there is a warm place. But it was just a special place. Gene.
Definition of
it was a particular kind of flower.
But they say from the vineyards? Something that grew in a vineyard?
Well, mine, let me see, where am I? Right. Exactly, and you know, just well, like you have a garden, and do you grow any flowers anywhere around it? No, you don't. Well, I have, Gene. Yeah, it's not all about food. Sometimes you're going to mix and mingle plants for various reasons, because they're beneficial to one another or whatever, and evidently that was the case here. And so I think she's just thinking, you know, she's a vineyard worker. She knows about the vineyards at En Gedi. And so she's familiar with this henna bloom that's there that is evidently a very, very pleasant thing. And he's like that to me. In a special place, a special flower.
So, henna must be.
Right, yeah, there you go. Dave?
Well, isn't henna a dye or a stain?
I'm sure it can be used that way, sure, yeah. Pardon? Oh, really? Okay. Well, I haven't started coloring my hair yet, so I don't know about that. Phil?
I didn't hear what she said, but Lucille Ball, that's what she used in her hair to keep it red.
Oh, really? Okay. Okay, I've heard of henna tattoos. Okay, yeah, so there you go. All right. Okay, now, this next section here is my favorite part, not that that matters to you, but is my favorite part in this whole song, because I like what they're doing here, and their playfulness with one another, their use of words and comparisons and how they pick up on what the other one is doing. I really love the interplay that takes place here, okay? So verse 15 through chapter 2, verse 3. Behold, he's speaking, you are fair, my love. Behold, you are fair. You have dove's eyes. Behold, you are handsome, my beloved. Yes, pleasant. Also, our bed is green. The beams of our houses are cedar and our rafters of fir. I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys. Like a lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. Like an apple tree among the trees of the woods, so is my beloved among the sons. I sat down in his shade with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. Okay, first of all, notice this, what they call each other. What does she call him, and what does he call her?
My
Who calls who, my love?
I think she calls him.
She calls him my beloved. And then every time he calls her my love, he says to her, my love, repeatedly through this song. She says repeatedly, my beloved. Why do we do that? Why can't we just refer to our spouse by name? Why do we have to give these other words? Okay, alright. I mean, doesn't it say something as to what you are to me? I mean, like our granddaughters were at our house the past couple days. And it's hard for me just to say Zoe or Lila. I mean, I can do it. I do it all the time. But sweetie? Or, I can't remember all the other things I was calling them yesterday, but there was a bunch, you know. Well, why? Just because that's what you are to me. You're sweet to me. Okay? Pardon? Right, or they're known as terms of endearment. You know, you are dear to my heart. And just simply to call you by your name, which there's nothing wrong with that, but it just, it's a special thing between the two of them. I believe it was Benaiah was the general, at least at first, of Solomon's army. Do you think when he reported to Solomon that he said, my beloved, here's what our troops are doing? Or do you think he said that to her? My love? No, it was just something they shared between themselves. Okay? And so that happens a lot here. Now, twice he says in verse 15, you are fair. Now, fair can have more than one meaning. Fair meaning like, you know, you're so-so. Or it can be a thing of great beauty. But then he says her eyes are like what? What was that, Hope? Doves. And remember we talked about that last week a little bit. You know, why did he say doves' eyes? And I had a hard time just trying to figure that out. I mean, I looked at some pictures of doves, but then for me what really worked was looking at a picture of an eye of an eagle. The eye of a dove, you know, it's open, it's round. There's nothing covering the eye. It looks pleasant, soft, and inviting. But have you ever noticed the eyebrow of an eagle? You know, it dips down. You know, how's that look like? Man, there's a rabbit, and he's a goner. You know, a dove doesn't do that. Okay, so I can't see him referring to her eyes as some kind of bird of prey. You know, what is a dove? You know, we know from Noah, you know, it's a sign that the flood's over. It's a beautiful sign. The Holy Spirit descended upon Jesus like a dove. It's something that's very beautiful and pleasant. So that's how her eyes were to him. Now, whether her eyes were literally all that beautiful, that's not the point. That's how he saw her. To him, she had that beauty. Okay? So she says that about him. And now he said that about her. Now she says, behold, you are handsome, my beloved. Yes, pleasant. Also, our bed is green. The beams of our houses are cedar and our rafters of fir. Interestingly, she's been comparing him to various things, but she doesn't do it there in verse 16, at least not yet. Now, I thought that was kind of interesting. She just says plainly what he is. You're handsome. Now, what is this reference to the bed, beams, houses, and rafters?
Strong.
Pardon?
Strong.
What was strong?
He was strong.
Oh, okay, you think that's referring to him. Oh, I never thought about it that way. Okay, for next week, I want you to think about the garden setting that they're in and continue to look at the comparisons that are made down through verse 3.